Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning, Arrowground versus Centerpoint Properties. Mr. Dorsey.
May it please the court. William Dorsey on behalf of the appellant, Arrowground, Inc., doing business as Menzies Aviation. In the case of Quincy Mall versus Carasotis, the Illinois Appellate Court confirmed that Illinois law requires plainly discoverable language to shift the burden of repair and replacement for structural changes and replacements that could last a lifetime from landlord to tenant. The Quincy Court went on to find that plainly discoverable language means language in a lease that is both clear and unambiguous. The district court below erred when it concluded that even though the lease was unclear, inconsistent, and ambiguous, that the lease nevertheless shifted the repair responsibility for the damaged concrete slab from the landlord to the tenant. Now, Menzies maintains that the lease itself is not ambiguous at all. It's unambiguous in its favor. Section 9.1 of the lease clearly states that any damage to the slab must be repaired by the landlord. In this case, the district court found that there was damage to the slab. And therefore, CenterPoint, as the landlord for the property, is responsible for the repair. But even if there were some ambiguity between sections 9 and 7 of this lease, that ambiguity must be resolved in favor of the tenant in light of the Quincy Mall versus Carasotis decision. And therefore, Menzies should prevail on its claim for breach of the lease. Now, why is that the Illinois rule? Why is it that Illinois finds that in the context of a structural repair or one that would last a lifetime, that the language in the lease must be clear and unambiguous? The reason is that the landlord is the one that has the superior knowledge about the property. In this case, CenterPoint built the facility that we're talking about. They're the ones who built the concrete slab. The second reason is that the landlord is going to be the one that is gaining the benefit of the structural repairs, the structural replacements, and the building itself before the tenant moves into the property, as well as after. And that's why Illinois has a rule that in these circumstances, the landlord is the one that bears the responsibility for these type of structural items. Now, the case of Rexam is a case that both parties have cited in the context of this case.
Counsel, I think you really need to discuss the language of the lease. That's
absolutely
the controlling document here.
Yes. Well, as it relates to Section 9.1, it's unequivocal in stating that any damage or destruction to a structural item or the building itself, and the building, well, specifically Section 9 talks about the definition of improvements. Improvements in the recitals of the lease is defined as the building and the improvements to the building. There's been no dispute in this case. In fact, it's a stipulated fact that the building includes the slab. And therefore, under Article 9, any damage to that slab is the responsibility of the landlord to repair or replace. If you look at the district court's findings, as a factual matter, she found in 6 different locations that the slab had suffered damage. And therefore, Article 9 is directly implicated, and it clearly addresses this type of damage.
What work does Section 7.2 do on your understanding?
Yes, Your Honor. As it relates to Section 7, there are two portions of that. One is Section 7.2b, which clarifies that the landlord is responsible for the roof, the walls, and the foundation of the building. Now, we have put forth evidence that the foundation is inclusive of the slab. In fact, the district court below found as a factual matter that she found as a factual matter that the slab had a dual nature as both a floor and a foundation. But Article 7 is addressed to the other types of items for repair and maintenance beyond just the roof, the walls, and the foundation of the building. As to Section 7.1, it addresses things like lighting, floor coverings, and included in that is the word floor. Now, the word floor, Your Honor, is not defined in the lease. It's not defined anywhere in the correspondence between the parties. But in the context of Section 7.2, which discusses the roof, the walls, and the foundation of the building, what we're calling the 6 sides of the box, we believe it clearly refers to the common understanding of floor, which is the top surface of of a property. For instance, if I say I dropped my pen on the floor, I'm not saying that I dropped it on a 6-inch piece of concrete that is currently holding us up. I'm talking about the visible surface that I can see. But at a minimum, given the court's finding that there was an ambiguity between the floor and the foundation in this case, that they had a dual nature, we believe that the lease is ambiguous even as it relates to Section 7 as to the way it allocates responsibility
for
slab repairs.
Your understanding is that CenterPoint should have come in and re-poured the slab.
They had an absolute obligation to replace the slab once it became so damaged.
Replace it to what, a six inch depth?
Well, Your Honor, we believe that was insufficient.
You leased the building as is,
absolutely,
which was projected to be a 6-inch depth, which would not have supported the activities of AeroGround.
That is correct, Your Honor. And we understand that our warranty claim, you know, did not survive at the trial court level, and we've not appealed that. But the as-is provision is what's governing that. That's as-is as of the time that you take it. And so we are not appealing.
So they come back in and they re-pour it to 6 inches. I know you contend that it was 4 inches in some places and so forth. But they re-pour it to 6 inches, it cures, and you start using it again with the activities that you're doing. It's going to do the very same thing all over again.
Absolutely, Your Honor. It would if my client chose to then go ahead and operate in the same fashion that it had in the past. One of the things that happened here, Your Honor, is that our client wasn't aware of the defects in the slab. It could have modified its operations to limit the use of its forklifts to areas in which those forklifts would not damage the facility. For instance,
but the slab, even as designed, would have not supported those activities.
Well, Your Honor, it's questionable as to whether it would have supported the 5,000-pound forklift, which is the bulk of the forklift traffic that's used in the facility.
What's the 30,000-pound?
The 30,000-pound forklift is when you get a really big piece of cargo once every couple of weeks that needs to be moved in the facility. It's not as much in use as the 5,000. And, in fact, I believe this is in the record before the trial court. Once our client found out that there was a issue with the slab, they confined the use of the 30,000 forklift to just one little portion of the slab in order to mitigate the damage to the slab. So we're not saying that CenterPoint had an obligation to repair or replace the slab up to some additional standard in light of the dismissal of our warranty claim, but they at a minimum had a duty to replace the slab as it was supposed to be there, a 6-inch concrete slab. So we distinguish between a warranty claim and what we're saying here, which is a breach of a duty to repair and replace. Now, Mr. Carlin, I am sure, is going to focus, as his brief does, on the issue of a floor is a floor. Everybody knows what a floor is, and that's what this concrete slab is. But I would like to point out that Mr. Richmond, who is CenterPoint's deal counsel, the one who drafted this form lease agreement, testified at trial that the only way he could tell whether this concrete slab was a floor or a foundation was to consult the structural engineering drawings of this building, as well as go consult a structural engineer so that he could tell whether the floor was, in fact, underneath the surface tied into the walls of the building. Given that this is the type of analysis that would be required, the type of specialized knowledge, none of which was available to the parties who negotiated this lease. It's undisputed that they were not structural engineers, that they were lay people negotiating this lease. It is unsupportable that the parties intended for a technical structural engineering meaning to govern whether the slab was the responsibility of the landlord or the tenant. CenterPoint is a sophisticated landlord. They own millions of square feet of property surrounding the Chicago areas. If they had wanted to assign responsibility for this slab to the tenant, along the lines of what the landlord did in Rexham, they knew how to do that, but they didn't manage to do it here. Another argument that's raised by counsel is in the context of Section 9.1, where there's a suggestion that Section 9.1, even though it has no such limitation anywhere in that provision, should be read to include an additional requirement that it be covered by an insured peril. First of all, there's no suggestion that such a provision should be read into a lease when the parties didn't negotiate it. That would be suggesting things that are not apparent from the lease and would be certainly inconsistent with Karasotis, but also inconsistent with typical provisions of contract interpretation. But the other thing that's clear is that it's also inconsistent with the party's intent. If you look at Section 8 of the lease, that's the insurance provision. If you look at Section 8, 8.1 assigns responsibility for basically every risk you could imagine to the tenant. And it says that the tenant has to name the landlord as an additional insured for everything from contents to workers' compensation to any kind of risk you can imagine, except for one, and that's the responsibility for the building. And that is found in Section 8.3. Section 8.3 assigns unequivocally the responsibility for insuring the risk to the landlord. Now, in this case, it would be completely unfair and inconsistent with principles of contract interpretation to disregard that allocation of risk to the landlord and impose without any insurance protection the responsibility on the tenant to take the repair and replacement of a slab that it's undisputed is going to cost more than $1 million to repair and replace and weighs tens, if not hundreds, of tons in concrete. It could not have been the party's intention. And the other thing that I think highlights the distinction between what we're talking about here in a slab versus, you know, the items listed in Section 7.1, like wall coverings and those kinds of things, if the roof of this property were to blow out or the walls were to fall over, it's unequivocal that CenterPoint would be responsible for repairing those items. Menzies did nothing but use what was the only permitted use for this facility, air cargo handling. It didn't do anything different than any other air cargo handling does. There was no testimony that it did anything different. It simply operated in the space the way the parties contemplated it, and the slab disintegrated as a result. It's a structural item. It's a portion of the building, and it's something, and it's a risk that CenterPoint assumed in this lease. But certainly, as it relates to Karasotis, the Illinois appellate court decision that addresses the fact that the language shifting responsibility has to be clear and unambiguous, it does not meet that standard.
Thank you, Mr. Dorsey.
Thank you.
Mr. Carlin.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Lawrence Carlin on behalf of CenterPoint, the appellee. This is a lease construction case. It's governed by the rules for interpretation of contracts. And as one of the questions to Mr. Dorsey pointed out, the beginning and end of that analysis often is the language the parties used in making their agreement. Mr. Dorsey began his discussion by talking about plainly discoverable language. The case that we cited in opposition to the Quincy Mall, and that rule really has its genesis in the Kaufman versus Shucorp case that was cited by both parties in their briefs. But that plainly discoverable language that we cite is the Rexam Beverage case. And look at the clause in the Rexam Beverage case and compare that to the language of this lease. In the Rexam Beverage case, the clause began, landlord shall have no responsibility for any repairs to the building whatsoever. Section 7.4 of this lease begins, the landlord shall have no responsibility, and that's at short appendix, page 35. The landlord shall have no responsibility for anything in the service or facilities or repairs of this building. Rexam Beverage, the clause then went on to say the tenant is responsible for the entirety of the building as though they owned it. That language is in 7.4. But there's a very clear statement. You want to start with what the intent of the parties was to this lease. Look at paragraph 34.15. It's a paragraph called absolute rent. It says, this is a net lease. The tenant shall be solely responsible for all repairs, replacements, operations, costs, and expenses incident to the ownership of this building that would otherwise be on the landlord but for the entry into this lease. If that is not a plainly discoverable shifting of the liability from tenant or from landlord to tenant, which merely tracks the Rexam Beverage analysis of this court from 2010. I don't know what more the landlord could say. And we should all understand. In Rexam Beverage, the court commented that the clauses in this lease are convoluted. But notwithstanding the convoluted language, it's plainly discoverable. Complex language does not make it less plainly discoverable. The complex language is largely a result of what we do here as lawyers and litigators and you as jurists. Cases come down like Kaufman that says landlord has a duty or a tenant has a duty to repair the roof. The roof needs to be torn off and replaced. Kaufman says, well, the lease didn't say replace. It only said repair. It didn't really anticipate extraordinary expenses like that. The commercial lawyers respond, and every lease after the Kaufman case now says repair or replace. Then a case comes down like Shapiro or Quincy Mall that says this was really an extraordinary, unforeseen expense. The commercial community responds by expanding the language to include extraordinary expenses. Here, the language of this lease, you have to read all the provisions together, 34.15, 7.4, 7.1, and 7.2. 7.1 is the starting point within Article 7. It says the tenant is responsible for the entirety of the building. And then it goes to delineate, including but not limited to, the floor. 7.2A was a clause, interestingly, that was not in the earlier February version of the lease. This lease was first entered into in February. The parties were in a prior lawsuit where Aeroground was basically trying to retrade the economic terms of the lease. It resulted in a lawsuit. That lease got ripped up. It was replaced by the November 2007 lease. During that interim period, while we were making $2 million worth of improvements to this building, adding dock doors and all these other things, to their specific specifications so it could be used for an air cargo facility, we also built a 60,000-square-foot addition off the building because they thought their business was going to expand exponentially. The market tanked between February and November, and they decided they no longer needed the expansion space. 7.2A specifically allocates how are structural repairs going to be dealt with when it's a single-user building versus when it becomes a multi-user building. That's what 7.2 is. And it's very interesting because what it says in unambiguous language is that structural repairs after it's multi-tenant will be carried out by the landlord but paid for proportionally by the tenants. But until the expansion space is leased, under 7.2A, all structural repairs are carried out by the tenant and paid for by the tenant. So 7.1 says they're responsible for the entire building, everything. 7.2 says they're responsible for structural repairs until the expansion space is leased. 7.2B says landlord's sole responsibility will be for the exterior walls, the roof, and the foundation. Mr. Dorsey says that Mr. Carlin's going to come up here and talk about the meaning of floor. I don't care what you call the 6 inches of concrete that was poured inside this building after the foundation was in place and the roof was in place. You can call it a floor, you can call it a slab, you can call it Fred. It doesn't make a difference. If it's not an exterior wall, and it clearly is not, and it is not a foundation, and it clearly is not, and it is not roof wall, I'm like, roof walls are foundation. It's not a wall, it's not a roof, it's not a foundation, it's not our responsibility. At trial.
Mr. Carlin, without that slab, was that a facility that, since you think it's separate from the foundation, is that a facility that was commercially usable? In other words, the slab is like a rug?
No. What I am suggesting is that the slab is an integral part of the building for depending what kind of use you want. It doesn't make it a foundation. The foundation we define, I think the common definition and understanding of foundation is what the rest of the building is built on. It's the part of it that's underground that supports the vertical loads into the ground. The slab was poured after the rest of the building was built. If I was leasing a 180,000 square foot warehouse to someone that wanted to use it for tractor pulls, or someone wanted to use it for indoor rodeos, they could go into that building, and it would be perfectly structurally sound with a dirt floor. You wouldn't need the slab to make that building a usable, enclosed, structurally sound edifice.
Is there a code, building code requirement that required a floor, required a slab?
Is there a building code requirement?
Right.
I really can't answer that. I do know that there are building codes with regard to the slab, depending on what use the building is going to be for and how it is zoned. This was submitted to zoning and plan review, and it was approved. The 6-inch unreinforced slab was put in this building in 1998 and lasted for 7 years without a scratch being on it. Their experts all testified as to what caused the slab to crack. Mr. Dorsey states that there, as is, breach of warranty claim that there was a representation this would be suitable for its permitted use is not in play anymore. That is not true. Read their brief. Pages 26, 28 of the original brief, pages 8 to 10 of their reply brief. One of the principal arguments they still have is fitness for use. It is now just presented in a different context. They're now saying it's a causation issue. We didn't cause the slab to crack. The slab was cracked and disintegrated because it had inadequate thickness. That's the words they use in their brief. The record in this case is eminently clear as to what caused the cracking. There were only three witnesses that were competent to testify to that. All of them engineers, two of them called by Aeroground. Bruce Bazella, who they called, and Peter Stork, an independent engineer from Wiss Janney, both testified using almost identical language. Bruce Bazella stated, and I think it's at page 315 of the record, that the slab cracked because the forklift traffic from Aeroground overloaded it. Peter Stork, in similar language, said the slab cracked because the forklift traffic from Aeroground loaded the slab beyond its capacity. Section 7.2B requires the tenant to pay for all repairs that are the direct result of the tenant's acts or omissions. And there has been no question that it was the Menzies Aeroground operations that caused the slab to crack. They loaded it beyond its capacity.
If 7.1 and 7.2 work the way you say they do, what's the purpose of 9.1? Does it have any purpose in this lease?
Yes. And I'll answer that first as Mr. Richmond, who drafted the lease, answered it, and then I'll expound on that. 9.1, I believe, should be read in the context of the lease in its entirety. You start out with Article 7, which covers repair obligations, repair covenants. This is our part of the building. This is your part of the building. You then move to Article 8, which is the insurance provisions, and Mr. Dorsey misinterprets them. Article 8.1 deals with the tenant insurance obligations. 8.1A, Romanet 2, requires them to have a general liability policy that covers property damage. It also requires extended coverage for premises operations. Menzies had an obligation under this lease to insure against property damage caused by their operations. The duty to insure was on them, not CenterPoint, for what caused the damage in this case. Then you move to Article 9. Article 9 is the restoration replacement provision of the lease. Article 9, according to Mr. Richmond, solely dealt with the incident of catastrophic loss that is covered by property insurance, earthquake, floods, tornadoes. Mr. Richmond was asked, why isn't insured peril in 9.1 as you drafted it? And he said, because it doesn't need to be. If you read the lease as a whole, including 9.2, which says that Aeroground will pay the deductible, not a deductible if it's an insured peril, but they will pay the deductible. It doesn't need to be in there. Now, to expound on that, as the commercial community responds to what happens in litigation, do I believe that every lease that Mr. Richmond drafts after this will include insured peril in the repair and replacement or the restoration clause? Absolutely. But it is my construction of this lease that the Article 9, if you define damage as they define damage, which is an item that fails prior to the end of its useful life, there is no repair that could be made because damage is what requires the repair. So it reads 7 completely out of the lease. If we're responsible for all damage, the only things that reason you need to make any repair in the first instance is because something is damaged, is they define damage. Article 7 becomes totally meaningless. Does the panel have any other questions?
Apparently not. Thank you, Mr. Carlin.
Thank you.
Let's see.
Thank you. As it relates to Article 9, Mr. Richmond's testimony was very interesting at trial because what was not talked about by Mr. Carlin was that in the original version of a lease for this property for a different tenant, Mr. Richmond did include a requirement that the loss be for an insured peril. That language was taken out of this lease. Now, Mr. Richmond may want to include it again, but he took it out of this lease, which is indicative of something that he meant to take out, not simply a failure to include it. With regard to the reference to Section 7.2a, I wanted to clarify that Section 7.2a says, except as provided to the contrary in Section 7.2b. So it's expressly subject to the requirement that landlord replace the exterior walls, roof, and foundation, which, again, you know, I know that Mr. Carlin would like to say it's clearly not a foundation. Judge Coleman below specifically found it had a dual nature as both a floor and a foundation. That's because the concrete slab ties into the exterior walls of this building. There are dowels that tie in the slab to the exterior walls of this building and provide some horizontal support for that building, and that was the testimony at trial, and it's what the judge relied on below to find that it had a dual nature. And in light of that ambiguity in Carasotis, again, we feel like at a minimum, the lease is too ambiguous in light of the Illinois rule. It's also important to distinguish the Rexham case from this one. The provision that goes on after the allocation of responsibility says that lessee shall be responsible for all structural and extraordinary changes that may be required. There's no language in this lease assigning structural responsibility to the tenant. Landlord certainly could have included that language. It didn't. And in fact, the intent of the parties is just the opposite. If you read the term sheets that were exchanged between the parties, not only after the first lease was signed, but leading up to when the second lease was signed, including one dated October 18th, just a couple of weeks before this lease was signed, the provision reads, as to lease type, a modified triple net lease whereby CenterPoint Properties will maintain the roof and structure over the life of the lease. In other words, the lease term sheet specifically says the structure is on the landlord, and that's consistent with 9.1, it's consistent with 7.2b, and it's consistent with the finding that the slab has a dual nature as both a floor and a foundation. As it relates to the building code question, Your Honor, there is a building code requirement of a foundation permit as part of this building, and as part of that foundation permitting process, this evidence was introduced at trial. The City of Chicago reviews the slab thickness and whether it's sufficient to support an operation of a warehouse on the facility. And as part of that foundation permit, again, using that same word that we're talking about here today, the city approved this slab.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Dorsey. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.